from the differently abled studios of WDIY FM in Bethlehem, PA. It is time for another button down hour, a chemical free horticultural hijinks. You bet your garden. Has tending your garden become a pain in the you know what? I'm Mike McGrath, and on today's show, I'll present lots of easy ways that you can hoe without getting hurt. Plus, Elliot Coleman, one of the greatest minds in the organic movement, explains that everything your garden needs in the future is right there in the present. And your super phone call questions, comments, tips, tricks, suggestions, and casually cautious communications. So stay right where you are, cats and kittens. It's all coming up right after the news.
WDIY presents a selection of award-winning podcasts that air weeknights from 6 to 7 p.m. Listen to important conversations regarding art, science, business, health, and more here in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Check our website for new topics and archived programs. WDIY podcasts are on 88.1 FM, streaming at wdiy.org, on the app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
From the muddy studios of NPR station WDIY in Bethlehem, PA, it is time for yet another hour of chemical-free horticultural hijinks, You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and this week we begin with a hot stove edition of In the News, for which we are using the original newspaper headline. There's finally joy in Mudville. Scientists uncover properties of the magical muck that Major League Baseball uses on official balls, begins the New York Times article by David Waldstein. Now, strategies and superstitions and strangeness have always been a part of America's pastime. For instance, number 4 on the top 5 official MLB list of strange things about the game, a Major League Baseball only lasts 6 pitches. Whether the ball goes out of the park, gets dirty or damaged, doesn't matter. A typical game goes through 5 to 6 dozen balls, although each club must have 90 on hand. I, however, have always been fascinated by number 2 on that list, MLB mud. Quote, every major league ball is covered in mud from a secret location in New Jersey. The mud is called Lena Blackburn Baseball Rubbing Mud and allows pitchers to get a better grip on the ball. Before mud, baseballs were rubbed in water and dirt and sometimes tobacco juice and shoe polish. As a rabid follower of what Walt Whitman dubbed the game of ball, I knew as a child that umpires had buckets of special mud on hand they would use to rub each baseball to make it darker. I didn't realize the mud also made the ball grippier. Ah, but I did know that that mud was supposedly local to somewhere in the area of my native southeastern PA. Quote the Times article, for decades, all the balls used in Major League Baseball have been coated with mud harvested from a secret spot along a Delaware River tributary in New Jersey. Only a few people know the exact location, and until recently, only a few knew the exact components of that mud. Now researchers have dug deep and found what they consider to be remarkable mechanical properties of this mud. Quote, it spreads like face cream and grips like sandpaper, explains a professor of earth and environmental science at the University of Pennsylvania who is also one of the authors of a paper on this subject, which was just published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science. The authors measured Lena Blackburn's baseball rubbing mud's viscosity levels of friction and adhesion and found this special substance to be composed of clay, tiny particles of quartz and other minerals, a little sand, and a small amount of material for plants and other living things. It's about 43% water by weight. Quote, what makes this mud special are the proportions of the ingredients, which gives the mud two characteristics that seem at odds with each other. The angular particles of sand are glued to the surface by the clay, acting like barnacles studding the surface of a ship. I wonder if rubbing my hands in Lena's mud would help me stop dropping everything.
Spread the word about your business or organization to a well-informed audience. Become an underwriter with WDIY. Our lineup of NPR News and locally produced programs reaches thousands of engaged listeners in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Underwriting on WDIY is an affordable and effective way to provide information about your product and services to people who care. To learn more about underwriting opportunities, 610-694-8100 or WDIY.org.
Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host. In just a little bit, I will reveal a number of tips that will help you garden without feeling the pain afterwards. Everybody out there needs to stay tuned for this one. Hazen, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
So glad to be here. I absolutely love your show. I kick myself every time I don't get to listen to it.
Well, if you miss it live, so to speak, you can always listen online at WDIY or a podcast or a repeat signal from the alien ships that are hovering around our planet. You know, it's easy to find. They can find it.
Okay, I'm on it.
All right, where are you, man?
I am in Spokane, kind of on the outskirts of Spokane, Washington.
Okay. I know that area well because back in the, was it still the 90s? Yeah. I originally confused it with Seattle. I have been re-educated, so I know about your growing conditions. And with that in mind, what can we do you for?
Well, my growing conditions are a little bit peculiar. I live sort of in a valley out in the country.
Right.
And I'm gone a lot. I travel. I work for National Geographic. And
wait,
so I'm gone
No, you don't get away with just saying that. Come on, man. Let's hear it.
Well, I don't know if you've seen the television show Primal Survivor on National Geographic or Disney Plus. That's my show. Hey, you can sleuth me. I'm Googleable.
And are you the host, the photographer?
Yeah.
You're the host.
I'm the host.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because I do get a lot of National Geographic articles and shows. I will sleuth you out, as you say.
Well, I love it. I love it. And if you've ever watched the show, it'll be apparent that I love plants. So.
Okay, very good. Yeah. Okay, so...
And then in my private life, okay, yeah, so when I'm not filming, I'm here on my farm. I got a big garden. I'm kind of a back-to-nature self-sufficiency guy, and I've got a great garden, amazing dirt. I'm out here in the Palouse. They say it's the deepest topsoil in the world due to the Missoula Great Flood.
Mm-hmm.
But I got a problem because it's so good that I got tons of weeds. Anyways, lots of distractions, lots of questions for you, but I'm trying to stay on track. I get frost here in August because I live in a valley here.
Yes.
So trying to grow tomatoes, I'm incredible at growing green tomatoes, and that's about it.
Well, let me stop you there and say one solution to that is there are tomato varieties, especially bred to be picked green, and that ripen up very slowly inside. The one that instantly comes to mind is called Winter Keeper, but there are many others. Okay, so we know you lose the end of summer. How about in spring? When are the nights reliably in the 50s in your valley?
Ooh, I couldn't tell you that we just have snow on this one peak, and when the snow disappears, that's when we all start planting in the ground.
I'm going to throw out a date, June 1st.
Yeah, I think we can. I think we can touch into May.
So I live in your opposite conditions. I live about 3/4 of a mile above sea level in the foothills of South Mountain here in Pennsylvania. So I have a weird season too. And, you know, I have to ask the question now, when are you gone?
So my garden setup is pretty sweet. So I've got ground cover. I have sub-irrigation. I can put my plugs in and leave it for months on end. It kind of depends. And then, like, I can be gone for 2 months, and voila, everything is grown, and I can start harvesting from the garden. It's a great setup.
Your only enemies are unpredictable frosts and a shorter season than most people have.
Yes, yes. So the question, what brought me here today, is I'm thinking about building a greenhouse better than just a hoop house. And sometimes when I do builds, they wind up being substantial, I guess. I don't know. And then I get myself carried away. And what I'm thinking about doing is building a greenhouse, and I have access to all of these old slider windows. So they're insulated panels, and I thought I was going to be clever and make a greenhouse out of these reclaimed window panels. And I was thinking that the insulation from the glass would be that much better. But then my question is that a good idea?
No.
And if I'm getting panels, these insulated panels, 4 foot by eight foot in dimension, and I line them all up, is there different coatings on some of this glass that doesn't allow whatever parts of the spectrum that my plants need? You know, does it block that stuff out?
Too many moving parts. And too difficult in the joining to make sure that you have a draft-free greenhouse. Don't put down hoop houses. They work extremely well, and they have, if you do it professionally, you know, just like they do on small farms, they will save you from summer. Which brings me to my next question for you. How hot does it get in the middle of summer, your summer?
It gets brutally hot.
Yeah. Okay. So any plants would fry in your greenhouse.
Okay. Yeah.
So hoop houses traditionally, you know, are giant metal hoops big enough for somebody to walk underneath them, and then stretched plastic with a door at one end that you can engineer. You can go out and get recycle an old storm door and stuff. Just make sure everything is well insulated. And then what you would buy is an automatic fan that would sit up at the back of the hoop house, at the back of the hoop, and be controlled by the inside air temperature. Because you say it gets brutally hot, I would recommend a fan as opposed to just louvers. And it'll come on when it's needed. When it gets chilly, say you have a 90-degree day and a 40-degree night, it'll shut off, and the louvers that allow the warm air to exit will close automatically.
Mm-hmm.
And you can do your watering system and everything inside there.
Okay.
That's really the only way you can grow a sustainable amount of food without possibly being there.
Okay. I've toyed around with the ideas of hoop house. I just kind of wanted the... I built my own house here. I built all the outbuildings, and I have a certain look. I kind of wanted it to look more like a permanent, maybe straight out of England, old-fashioned greenhouse.
Do you have that kind of money?
You know, before, but I have the capabilities. I'm a professional builder, so I can make it look cool, but
well,
I also want it to work. So.
I wouldn't use the salvaged windows. What you can do with them is on the south-facing side of your property, you could build wooden boxes and use the windows on top of them to start your seeds. But even for that, you would need an automatic venting system, or you would need to be home and prop up the windows during the day and close them at night. See, that's the thing. Anything you grow will have to be vented during hot times. But it would allow you to plant May 1st and harvest into September, no problem. Again, to build a conservatory, I would want the proper glass, things like that. And I think in terms of expense, reality, and ability to get this done for this season, a hoop house would be great. And I'd want you to build it permanently. I'd want you to have some sort of foundation, which you would build, of course. You know, throw your own touches onto it, but keep thinking that cold air can't come in and hot air must go out.
Sounds good. Okay.
And there's a name for those things, seed-starting things I described, but my brain will not let me access that panel.
Well, Mr. McGrath, I so appreciate hearing you and listening to your advice all the time. So as soon as the snow starts melting, I'm ready to get busy.
I hear you. And we love being on the air. You call it Spokane, right?
Hope not.
No,
Spokane.
You call it Spokane. Okay. All right. Well, I will look up your show. I hope you'll continue listening to my show. And I think you have all the information you need to achieve your goals very, very realistically.
Thank you so much, Mr. McGrath. And yeah, if you get a chance to watch Primal Survivor, go do it.
I'll look it up. All right.
Take care. Bye-bye. So much.
Bye-bye. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and mention that it is now time to officially drench your mind in the contents of this year's seed catalogs and seed supplier websites. Get some new ideas for this year's garden. Reinforce some of your favorite old choices, or just dream away, considering all of the endless choices, perhaps helping you ignore your current out-of-doors garden situation. But don't go dreaming those little dreams just yet, because we'll be right back to talk with one of the acknowledged masters of self-sufficient growing and take more of your self-sufficient phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA.
Do you have vinyl albums, 45s, or CDs on your shelves that are taking up space and gathering dust? Why not donate them for a good cause? WDIY will receive profits from the donation, and you can claim a tax deduction. For more information, or to arrange for a drop-off or pickup, call 610-694-8100 or visit WDIY.org.
Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host. Coming up later in the show, I will reveal quite a number of tips that will help you garden without feeling the pain afterwards. But right now, I am promoting a very special guest. This is a real treat for me. Elliot Coleman is one of the fathers. You know, he would be on Mount Rushmore of organic advocates. He has come out with a new book that really explains a lot about how far we've come in the last 30, 40, 50 years. It is The Self-Fed Farm and Garden, A Return to the Roots of the Organic Method, and it is brand spanking new from Chelsea Green Publishing. Elliot, it's so wonderful to have you back on the show.
Well, Mike, it's been a long time since we talked, but I'm glad to be back on your show.
I should mention that in the past, Elliot has produced some books that are real Bibles for organic growers, the Four Season. What's the exact name of that one?
Four Season Harvest was the one for home gardeners. If there are commercial growers who also want to grow in the winter in unheated greenhouses, there's a book for them too.
And I should mention that while I talk about it and I have a little home garden, you walk. I mean, you walk your talk. And for many, many years, you did a lot of hard labor on these farms to magical success. Elliot means what he says, kids, when he grew food for 12 months of the year on the chilly coast of Maine.
Yes, and the best thing about that was it wasn't focused on heated greenhouses. It was on unheated greenhouses with a layer of fabric above the crops inside the greenhouse, so you had a double-covered area.
And right.
Basically, the reason it worked was each layer of covering moves the zone you live in further to the south, and with two layers of covering, we were able to turn Maine into Georgia.
Oh, wow. I got to come out for some peaches. Now, this book really is a history of what we've been doing since the 70s and 80s and how things have changed. Back in the beginning, especially during the time I was editor of Organic Gardening, we did a lot, and you cover this well in your book, about what inputs you could put into your garden and still be considered organic.
Yes, but that's because, and I think the simple reason for that is that magazines are supported far more by their advertising income than by their subscriptions. And so any magazine that wants to stay in business is going to need to take advertising. And the people most likely to advertise on a gardening magazine are companies selling garden products.
Yep.
Yes.
Now, you and I, we had not met. Nobody knew who I was when I came out of the woodwork. But I had been growing a fabulous organic garden for 10 years before I took over the magazine, and it never occurred to me to buy stuff.
Yeah, but if I went in back then to my local seed and feed store, even so much as mentioned the word organic, the guy would brighten up and suddenly try and sell me soybean meal or dried blood or all of those things, because he was aware that there were an alternate group of gardeners who thought those products were better. And so depending on where you were, if the USDA wasn't in charge, the storekeepers in the garden world were anxious to sell you all those organic inputs.
One of the things I have been especially pleased with in the movement over the years is the transition to, quote, no spray. You know, we're not using anything that we have to buy. Your whole book is a testimony to how you don't have to buy anything. You just have to manage the stuff that's on your property correctly.
That's a good way to put it. The person who was making that argument years ago, surprisingly enough, was Edward Faulkner. The thing is, if you go on the web to any of these no-till sites, you will find they're always citing Edward Faulkner as the father of no-till. They should be embarrassed they didn't read past the cover page of his first book, Plowman's Folly, because, yeah, he thought plowing was a bad idea, plowing with a turn plow, because it buried all the surface organic matter in the bottom of the furrow. But he was 100% in favor of tillage, as long as it was tillage that was mixing organic matter into the top 4 inches of the soil.
I know that a lot of people who listen to my show have been doing this for a decade or more, because one of the questions that's been popping up frequently is, my raised beds seem a little bit heavy. And I'd go, well, how long ago did you build these beds? And they go, 15, 20 years ago. And I go, well, even though in the past we told you to throw away your rototiller and everything like that, it might be time to resuscitate that bed, loosen up the soil. I'm a huge fan of perlite. That's the only thing I bring onto my property.
Oh, yeah. It's a good product, yes.
And it lightens the soil. To have to do that like once every 15 years is not a burden. And then I also really stress that once they're done their tilling, they've done their soil amendment, leveled everything out, I urge them to soak the soil to where it can't hold any more moisture, and then wait 10 days for any buried weed seeds to come to the surface, and then just slice their little heads off with a diamond hoe, and you won't have weed problems the rest of the year. That's the stale seedbed, right?
That stale seedbed is the perfect name for that technique, yes.
So what do you want people to do? Is it as simple, because simple ideas tend to be the best, to really start looking around their property for all these inputs that they may be neglecting or putting out at the curb, or even worse, misusing? You know, people who think a compost pile can be all garbage, and you and I know it can't. You need browns and you need greens, and it's great if you can turn it. But it's no more work for the homeowner or the small-scale gardener. It's just a different type of work.
Yes, yes, absolutely. During the writing of this present book, I ran into a study that was done back in 1950 in New Jersey on all of their very sandy soils. And the author of the study's name for the technique was land resting.
Right.
And land resting, as he defined it, was sowing the soil to a pasture mix. And he found out that doing that, even if you're a commercial grower for 1 year out of every three, you improved your general yields amazingly. And that's because there is nothing as good as a year in sod to put fertility, old-time fertility, back into the soil.
Now, wasn't this even biblical, as in on the seventh day you will rest, right?
Yeah, interesting, yeah. Well, the whole concept of land resting has been proven by farmers in England and Europe for many years, and they have found that the best way to have an almost perennial farm is to put the land into pasture mix, graze it with grazing animals, and then after 4 years of that, till it up shallowly with a rototiller, and then grow 4 years of alternating grains and fodder crops. And what you were doing, the years in pasture being grazed, and that was being fertilized on a daily basis by the droppings from the livestock, but that allowed the soil to build up organic matter because of the roots, the deep roots of all the pasture crops. And then after 4 years of that, you got 4 years without having to add any fertilizer because you were, during the 4 years in pasture, you were building up fertility, and then you could spend 4 years exploiting that fertility, and at the end of the second 4 years, you put it back into grass pasture again. This was known as ley farming, L-E-Y, and it was probably the most successful back in the 40s system for perpetual fertility.
And to make this applicable to home gardeners, think of the number of raised beds that you have. And depending on that number, give one or two of them at least a year's rest.
You got it.
To recover. Yep. But meanwhile, you know, you just got to keep track. And then at the end of that year, you move on to the next set of beds and you take your time to get the job completely done. But when it's done, you're in the cycle. You know, this is part of your garden life now.
Yes, yes, absolutely. For a lot of people, maybe they only have a small yard and only a few raised beds. That isn't going to be easy to grow your fertility in the soil you're growing vegetables in. But it turns out that you can grow green manures during the times of the year the garden is not growing vegetables.
In the winter, yeah.
In the winter or in the between winter and spring or between summer and fall, there's lots of ways to grow homegrown fertility right in the same land that you're growing your vegetables on.
But I would also suggest that if you are making really high quality compost that you can get by with just a crop rotation, you know.
Yes, and in fact, I explain in the book that we don't, on our market garden, make very much compost anymore because we now, rather than harvesting a lot of crops and taking them to a place where you're processing them for market, we now do all that processing right in the field. So let's say we're harvesting leeks.
Right.
We'll go out there and we'll pull the leeks, peel off any outer leaves that don't look beautiful, cut off the tops, cut the roots off, and then leave all that trash right in the leek bed, because when it's over, we then go through there with the rototiller, till all of that in shallowly, and then put that land into a green manure. And I already own the leek trimmings, so the idea that I was going to compost them, I'm taking them away from the garden. If I leave them right in the garden and till them in, and then add more with the green manure, I have a pretty good system going.
Well, listen, I'm going to get in trouble if I go on much longer with you. But I want to mention we've been talking to Elliot Coleman, who is semi-retired from his four-season farm. He has a great new book out from Chelsea Green. It's called The Self-Fed Farm and Garden, A Return to the Roots of the Organic Method. But Elliot, once again, it has been a distinct pleasure. I wish you success with the book. I urge everybody out there to get it. And if you ever have something you want to say, you got my number now.
Okay. After many years of sort of not communicating, it's great to be chatting with you again, Mike, and I wish you all the best with your show of your other project.
And the same to you, and enjoy your semi-retirement. You have earned it. All right.
Thank you, sir.
My pleasure.
Good to talk to you.
Yep. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and suggest that a membership to the station that produces and distributes this show, WDIY-FM, would make an excellent gift for a devoted listener who's hard to shop for, or yourself, not to mention us here at the station. But don't go signing up your friends and family at WDIY.org just yet, because we'll be right back with tips on how to ease or even prevent your outdoor aching back. And of course, we'll take more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. Hey, anybody on our crew know what we have planned for next week's show? I'm Mike McGrath, and the crew all ran out of the room, so we got no idea what you'll hear. Join us anyway for the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, and be surprised as the rest of us. Plus your fabulous phone calls. That's on the next You Bet Your Garden. Welcome back to another thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden from the studios of WDIY-FM in Bethlehem, PA. I am your host, Mike McGrath, and yes, we are in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, I will reveal quite a number of tips that will help you garden without feeling the pain afterwards. And you'll hear it after another phone call at 610-694-8100. Every once in a while, we get a call from a listener that would make a great Q&A on the air, but they are not available during our taping time. So that's what's coming up right now. Here's the question.
Hi, my name is Monica. I'm calling with a couple of tree-related questions. I'm calling to try to help my parents who have a lilac tree they planted near their house that had a significant limb blown off during a recent severe storm. and I'm wondering if there's something that can do that they can do to help that exposed area where the limb was torn off to protect it from pests. The other question is, they have a couple of eastern redbud trees they've planted near their house. They planted them, I believe, in 2020. They have been doing fine up until now, and now one of them still seems to be fine and healthy and has bloomed and budded, but the other tree has not blossomed, has not gotten leaves like the healthy tree has. And when we look at it more closely, we can see it seems to have some kind of fungus on the sides of the tree and around the base of the tree. The color of the fungus seems to range from like a white or a gray color to a kind of orange color. I'm wondering what can be done to help this poor tree. Somebody told them they should replace the tree, but I would think if you don't get rid of the fungus, even if you remove the tree and put a new one there, it would be susceptible to the same fungus. Thank you.
Well, I have to agree with the person who gave you advice. It sounds like that lilac tree or redbud, I've kind of lost track of which tree we're talking about, but it doesn't matter. I think maybe it's a redbud. The one with the fungus that, you know, hasn't leafed out well, didn't bloom, that tree is dead. It just takes a while for a tree to look really most sincerely dead. I would not worry too much about fungal organisms, but when you do remove the tree, make sure you have the stump pulled, not just ground down, because if you just have it ground down, then you can't plant anything else there. Whatever it is could spread to the other redbud, and so you want to get it out as quick as possible to prevent that. Then, as to any remaining fungus in that area, I would say your best bet is, first of all, if there's any wood mulch involved here, rake it away from all your trees. Matter of fact, remove it and replace it with 2 inches of really high-quality compost. Wood chip mulch can give trees disease that's lurking in the mulch, but compost defeats disease organisms. It literally eats them for breakfast. Do you have to plant another tree exactly there? Because I would suggest you move a little to the side, maybe 2 feet away from that original spot, and plant a different type of tree. But if you're going to plant another redbud, don't plant it in the exact same spot. It sounds like they might also need some space in between them for ventilation to prevent this happening again. And as to the lilac, I seem to remember an email that showed a huge branch torn off the side. It is vitally important that you do not try and help the tree. Tree sealers are useless and can cause further damage. The tree needs to have that area open to the air so it can grow new cambium over that site and protect itself. You know, that's really all you can do. It's really all you should do. I doubt if insects are going to attack it. Insect attacks on lilacs are limited to bald-faced hornets stripping a lot of the bark off in the fall to make their nests. They're really not known to attract any kind of special wood-boring insect or that. So even though it goes against your grain, just leave it alone. Don't look at it. As promised, it is time for the question of the week. Gardening for the differently abled and all of us who are simply getting less young. Julianne in Glenside, PA, home of the fabulous Keswick Theater, where back in the day I saw Dave Mason, Steve Stills, and many others at this historic 1,300-seat venue. She writes, I'd love to hear your tips, tricks, and advice for people who love to garden but have to contend with physical disabilities or limitations. I've had a lot of health problems this year, including a broken foot, and I'm not fully back up to speed in the garden. But gardening is so important to my mental health. I'm sure there are people of all ages with a variety of physical issues that would love to hear how to garden in the body they have right now. You couldn't be more correct, Julianne. This topic is so important that I created an entire talk on it for some of my personal appearances, advised the creators of a planned community garden on how to make sure the result would be ADA compliant, and designed a small-scale working garden for a facility whose residents had physical limitations. So I know a little bit about what I'm talking about for a change. Anyway, bullet point time. Wide lanes. The walking paths in my garden, installed when I was in my 30s, are much too small to accommodate a wheelchair, a walker, or a rollator. They can barely accommodate me. Luckily, half of the original beds were framed with local field stone, and we, my helper and I, mostly him, are slowly repositioning the stones inward to make the lanes wider. Balance. I do not want to fall on uneven ground. Heck, I don't even want to fall, period. So with the aid of my ninja helper, Sean, we are leveling out the uneven spots. Okay. Sean does the work. I stand there and say, you missed a spot. Garden grab bars. Hammer some pipes into select areas of the garden in case you start feeling unsteady so you can grab a hold of them. If you have or can create a vertical garden up against a sturdy wall, consider installing real bathroom-style grab bars to help you get down a little lower and get back up without calling for help. And yes, this is the voice of experience. Grow up. Install tall-growing perennials where the flowers will be up where you want them. Trellis anything you can, like pole beans, indeterminate tomatoes, and cucumbers for easy picking and no bending. Critical. If you find yourself beginning to bend, stop immediately and rethink the chore. Fact, put a do not bend sign in your garden. Tabletop gardening. Do you have a nice flat patio or other outdoor space with full sun? Get some of them big white folding tables, or even better, picnic tables, and arrange good-sized rectangular planters around the edges. Make sure they can be easily assembled and installed on site, maybe by somebody who owes you a favor, or you can pay somebody to do it. Hey, it's the gig economy. You're right there. Take advantage of it. Use the containers atop the tables to grow flowers, herbs, well-behaved pepper plants, and determinate tomato varieties that specifically define themselves as bush or dwarf. Improvements in breeding over the years have made it possible to grow full-size tomatoes on plants that top out at 2 or 3 feet tall. Really, I've grown several dwarf varieties, including my personal favorite, Tasmanian chocolate. Okay, but it tastes like a tomato, not chocolate. Don't stoop to the level of weeds. There are several devices that do the job of dispatching unwanted plants while you remain standing, like the water-powered weeder, a long spike that you attach to your garden hose, shove into the soil, pull the trigger, and it floods the weed up and out of the soil. Or a propane-powered flame weeder. My preferred model was introduced by Burns-O-Matic decades ago. It's a simple shepherd's hook design. You attach a small camp stove-sized propane bottle on the short end, turn a dial to release the gas, and click the automatic igniter that shoots an adjustable flame at the weeds you wish to kill by dehydration, or standing there, you burn them to a crisp. We don't judge. There are many other styles out there. I recommend strongly you stick to the shepherd's hook. Additional resources. One of the best sites I found online is produced by the Victoria State Government Department of Health in conjunction with the Horticultural Therapy Association of Victoria. Yes, it's from Australia, but every word is relevant to us in the U.S. and other countries. They cover many great ideas I didn't have room to mention here, and they have an audio link for the vision impaired. We'll post that link online with this question of the week. Money and labor. Yeah, the elephants in the room. Any enterprise like this is going to require some amount of initial investment and physical work. If you can't afford it, reach out to your city, state, municipality, or horticultural school to see if they can subsidize some or all of the project. Labor. If you can't afford to hire a part-time helper, contact your local Girl Scout, Boy Scout, or similar organization. Making a garden handicapped accessible would be a great Eagle Scout or Gold Star project. Come on, help a kid to get a merit badge while you get a garden. And finally, many sources suggest stretching before you go outside to work. This is dangerously outdated advice. A multitude of studies have found that stretching cold muscles greatly increases the risk of injury. The best alternative is to warm up passively with a warm shower and maybe take some Tylenol or ibuprofen an hour in advance if that's medically okay for you. Sure was a lot of advice about how to achieve produce without pain, now wasn't it? Luckily, you can read those details over at your leisure or your leisure by following the link for the Gardens Alive question of the week at the top of the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Yikes, my producer is threatening to hide my grab bars if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 610-694-8100. Or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, you're wretched refuse, teeming to our garden shore at youbetyourgarden1@gmail.com. No matter what, if you happen to live anywhere, please tell us where it is. And visit our Facebook page where we post new photos of our gardens and yours every day. Share your observations and feedback. Provide important and informative updates about the show. A link to the written version of the Gardens Alive Question of the Week and links to our priceless podcast. It's all at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. You Bet Your Garden is a public radio show and podcast produced and delivered to you every week from the studios of NPR station WDIY in Bethlehem, PA. You Bet Your Garden was created by Mike McGrath. Mike McGrath was created when he won the English prize, $25 cash money from the Sacred Heart Society at St. Bartholomew's Parochial School, and he has been following the easy money ever since. Our musical director is Ken Queter. Our social media director is Amanda Northfleet. Our peerless prince of profound production is James Zipro. Margaret McConnell is the executive director of WDIY-FM. Our executive producer is the always lovely Jonas Bowen. And our incredible assistant is the awesome Ninja Sean. Once again, special thanks to our very special guest, Elliot Coleman. His highly recommended new book, The Self-Fed Farm and Gardening, A Return to the Roots of the Organic Method, is brand new from Chelsea Green Publishing. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and I'll be dusting off my seed starting supplies until I see you again next week.
Yeah.